school. You just don't ask a guy to do something like that. I was set to go to the junior prom with Steffi Hoppington. She was counting on me. And on July 4th, I was planning my first skydive with my pals. I'd already put a deposit down on the plane ride. But my family isn't like other families, because Dad and Mom are actors, not just regular thespians either. Biggs and Julie Boraday are both movie stars, the kind that appear on the cover of cheap newspapers at the grocery store checkout line with headlines that announce every month that their marriage is ending. Splitsville is the way one magazine put it last March. These reports were obviously bogus. Mom and Dad were more together as a couple than the parents of anyone else I knew, which maybe isn't saying much, but still. The weird press and the fact that family was important to Mom and Dad was partly the reason Dad decided to relocate us to Lectus, supposedly the newest, hottest place for the elite to set up residence. He wanted the family to be someplace more private, away from the ever-prying eyes of the paparazzi, was how he put it. My school, Fleamont Prep, has some real rich kids in it, but just the same, all my friends were super impressed that we were going to Lectus. Real estate on Lectus costs so much that only billionaires could afford it. But with Mom and Dad's combined star power, they were able to buy a private ranch on the newly terraformed planet at the outer edge of the solar system. Plus, first-class tickets on the new high-speed luxury space transport, Gaddis. Not one of us four kids wanted to go. My older sister, Felicia, cried day and night until her face was permanently puffed. My younger twin brothers, Chester and Chomper, weren't any happier. We gave Chomper that nickname because as a baby he liked to bite everything in sight. I tried to reason with Dad about the inconvenience of living so far away from the movie industry, but Chester and Chomper just plain out begged, pleading not to be taken from their friends. I don't think Mom was even really that thrilled about the move, but she was philosophical about it. "Lectus is supposed to be gorgeous," she said, trying to console us. "And it's a wonderful hopping-off point to some of the really desirable other planets that are so popular these days as movie locations. Dad and I can be home much more often this way." We were standing on the docking platform when Gaddis came into view. I had to admit, the huge space transport was something to see. It was so gigantic, I felt like a microbe standing next to it. And it had these two giant green headlights in front. As it descended into its transport dock, its engine purred steadily. "All aboard, kids," Dad instructed as we crossed the walkway. When we reached Gaddis, we entered a dark walkway. It was soft and the floor was cushiony under my feet. "What is this?" I asked Dad. "It's a biotransport," Dad explained. "All our biological needs are built right into the structure of the ship." "Do you mean I could bite this floor and there would be food in it?" I asked in disbelief.
"Yep."
"Weird," I mumbled. In no time at all, we arrived at our new home on the planet Lectus. As the transport docked, an uneasy feeling overcame me. Maybe it's just fear of the unknown, I told myself. How I wish now that had been true. As soon as we disembarked, a space bus whizzed us out to our ranch. It was a vast expanse, but there wasn't much livestock other than a few goats. Huge white tumbleweeds blew across the flat acreage. "It doesn't look like much now, but once we've had a chance to fix it up, you're going to love it," Dad said, opening the front doors to our new home. As I stepped inside the big empty ranch house, I wasn't so sure. That eerie feeling was still with me, and rattling around this huge vacant place wasn't helping. "Let's go home," Chester requested. "I don't like it here."
"Me neither,"
Felicia seconded him.
"Give it a chance," Mom said. "Once we move our belongings in, it'll feel more like home."
That night, I tried to call Steffi, but as I'd suspected, the satellite signal didn't reach back home. Felicia must have discovered this at the same time I did, because I heard her shouting from her new bedroom,
"This is hell! We are living in hell now!"
The next day couldn't have been more boring. There was no one around. I actually missed going to school. Desperate for something to do, I wandered to the farthest edge of our property and was really happy to discover another luxurious ranch house very like ours. At least we weren't completely alone out here. I approached nervously, feeling awkward about just introducing myself to strangers. I came up on a grassy hill behind my new house, and from there I could see into the yard. My nearest neighbors had a pool, and someone was floating in it. Feeling encouraged because I wouldn't actually have to knock on the door in order to meet my new neighbors, I quickened my pace. As I got closer, I saw that the person floating there in the pool was possibly the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. She looked to be about my age, maybe a little younger, but not much. This girl was too awesome to be real. For a moment, I was sure I was dreaming. The sun glistened off her dark hair, and her skimpy bikini revealed a figure that made all thoughts of Steffi Hoppington fly out of my head. "Hi, I'm Phil," I said as I climbed over the split rail fence separating our properties. "I just moved into the ranch next to yours." She swam to the pool's edge and propped herself up on her elbows. Her brown eyes studied me in a languid, sleepy kind of way. "I'm Echenia." "Pretty name." "Thanks." She was so beautiful. "Is school done for the season?" I asked. "I'd sort of like to meet some other kids." Echenia shook her head. "Everyone has private tutors on Lectus."
"Why?"
"Kidnapping," she answered in a low, secretive tone.
"What?"
I asked. Echenia nodded. "Kids around here sometimes just disappear. Older people, too." She snapped her fingers. "Whole groups of people. Entire neighborhoods. Poof. Gone. Just like that."
"Has anyone ever demanded a ransom?"
I asked. I figured that the reason for the kidnappings was because Lectus was such a wealthy planet. Echenia shook her head.
"Never. And no one has ever come back."
"Wow," I murmured.
Suddenly it occurred to me that maybe she was a little crazy. Could what she was telling me be true? It seemed impossible. But she was so hot and gorgeous that I desperately hoped she wasn't also a loon.
"With all these disappearances, aren't you scared to be out in the pool all alone?"
"I'm not alone."
She gestured back to the house, and for the first time, I noticed armed guards dressed entirely in black stationed on two of the balconies.
"Telescopic long-range rifles," she reported.
Instinctively, I backed away from her.
"Don't worry,"
she assured me with a twinkling laugh. "I have a hand signal for danger, and I didn't give it."
"I didn't know Lectus was such a dangerous place."
"I know. The real estate people don't tell you until you're already here. Lectus is a very weird place. It's not so bad these days, not like before."
"What happened before?"
"Nothing. Forget it. It was a long time ago. I was just a little kid. My father managed to take us off the planet for the worst of it. He thinks it's safe again now, but..."
She glanced back at the bodyguard stationed on the balconies.
"He's not taking any chances."
"Did anyone ever figure out who was causing the disappearances?"
She shook her head.
"Nope."
"Strange."
"Wanna come over to my house sometime?" I asked.
"When?"
"Tonight?"
"Sure. 8 o'clock, okay?"
"Sure. It's right over there," I said, pointing.
"See you at 8.
Echenia arrived promptly, with two armed guards at her side. Dressed in a short, flowing white sundress, she looked unbelievable. Chomper answered the door.
"Phil, your girlfriend is here,"
he bellowed. "Shut up," I said, bopping him on the head as I came to the door.
"Hi."
Echenia left the guards outside and stepped in. My parents came down the stairs to see who would come in.
"Oh my gosh, Biggs and Julie Boraday!"
Echenia gasped. She turned to me.
Why didn't you tell me that's your last name?
Because people act the way you just did, I explained.
Oh, sorry.
Not at all, Mom told her. We love to meet our fans, don't we, Biggs?
She was using her silky movie star voice. Can't have enough fans, Dad agreed spryly. His shoulders were back and his chin up. It was his public stance, the one he took out when he played the assortment of heroic types he'd built his career on. He was always cast as a brave policeman, a fearless astronaut, a noble superhero, a brilliant detective. Whatever the role, Dad's character always saved the day. A worried expression suddenly swept over Echenia's face.
You didn't tell your other movie star friends about Lectus, did you?
No, but a story about it ran in the Daily Snitch, Mom told her.
Why do you look so worried?
Lectus just isn't as nice when it gets crowded, Echenia said.
That's when the scary things start happening.
They have kidnappings here, I said. Disappearances, whatever you want to call it. Did you know about that?
No, Dad admitted, looking concerned.
There are other things, too,
Echenia said, seeming very distressed.
Like what? Mom asked.
Echenia wrung her delicate hands.
I really don't want to talk about it. I should be going.
But you just got here, I protested.
Tell us what the other scary things are. I'm sorry.
She headed for the door, pulling it open. Her bodyguards closed in beside her and stayed that way as she hurried down the front walk.
Maybe we should have bodyguards, too, I suggested as I watched her go.
We came here to get away from the need for bodyguards, Dad reminded me.
Are you sure she isn't a little...
He tapped his forehead.
You know, unreliable.
Phil's girlfriend is wacky,
Chomper shouted gleefully from his spying place behind the couch.
Shut up, I told him.
I turned back to Dad. I don't know. The thought occurred to me, I admitted. The whole bit about overpopulation bringing on the bad stuff is kind of strange.
It is. And I wouldn't worry about overpopulation anyway, Dad said. Right now, I haven't seen anyone for miles.
Speaking of overpopulation, I guess this is a good time to tell you, Mom said, smiling. Lectus is about to get a bit more populated. I went to the doctor's this morning. I'm pregnant. With triplets.
Every day, the holographic TV showed footage of Gattis arriving at the Lectus transport dock, its four thick landing columns set firmly on the planet before the body of the transport settled down over them, its purring engine so steady and relentless, and then more and more new arrivals streaming off. Remembering what Echenia had said, I was alarmed at how quickly the population was climbing. Added to that, half the women in Lectus seemed to be pregnant. Mom joined a support group called Mothers of Multiples.
The meetings are more packed every time, she reported one evening after returning from a meeting.
Dad was composing a spoken letter into his recorder and he switched it off. That's because the news has spread that you're there, Julie. Don't forget you're a movie star. They've all come out to see you.
I don't know, Mom disagreed. There are some very full-looking women there, and a lot of them.
Felicia glanced up from the couch where she was perusing a beauty magazine of some sort.
They're probably stuffing themselves with padding just to see you, she commented. I'm not sure, Mom murmured.
Well, I'm sending a letter of protest to the agents who sold us this ranch, Dad said. They have oversold the property here. We're being inundated with the very crowns we came to escape. I can only think they've dropped their prices sharply. How else can so many newcomers be able to afford it here?
It was amazing how fast things were changing. McMansions began popping up everywhere you looked. One day there would be an empty field, and by the next morning there would be a huge house on it. The roads were clogged with giant trucks dragging prefabricated homes behind them. They clicked together like enormous Legos.
I tried to get in touch with Echenia by hanging around by her pool since I didn't have her phone number. I couldn't go to her front door because the guards wouldn't let me pass by. Finally,
I did come upon her swimming in her pool. With my eyes on the guards watching from the balconies, I hopped the fence, hoping Echenia wouldn't give them her secret danger hand signal. Echenia swam to the edge of the pool, though she wouldn't look at me. "Why did you run off that day?" I asked directly. "When I heard your mother was pregnant, I knew it was starting again," she replied. "What?" "The births. The crowding. I just can't stand to live through it again. Even though I was a child, I still remember." Her voice was climbing to a hysterical pitch. "You really think the disappearances will start again?" I asked. "I don't want to talk about any of it. You'll find out for yourself. My parents are planning to leave Lectus as soon as they can sell the ranch. Tell your family to leave too." I nodded. "Okay. Does your father really think it's not safe now?" I was on the trail of something. Maybe Echenia had this irrational fear, and her father knew it was all in her head. What if the bodyguards were just there to calm her fears? "When Daddy married my stepmom, she wanted to come here, and Daddy isn't able to say no to her about anything. But now we've convinced her to leave, too." "Maybe whatever it was won't happen again," I suggested. "Your father thought it was safe to return. You were little. You could have misunderstood what was going on." "Maybe," she conceded, though she looked unconvinced. "I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Please go away." She dove under the surface. I waited for her to come up again. I had so many questions. But she stayed under, swimming in circles for a very long time. Movement up on the balcony made me nervous, so I went back to my side of the fence and headed home. That evening was warm. I was in the yard watching Chester and Chomper on the swings. Mom and Dad were in the house and Felicia was out with friends. Friends were no longer in short supply. I'd made a few myself, but nobody that I really clicked with. No one else seemed to be worried about Echenia's strange disappearance stories, or had even heard of them for that matter. Coming across the yard, I saw a figure walking toward me in the dusky light. It was Echenia. I noticed she seemed to wobble unsteadily. I ran to meet her. As I got closer, I could see that she was frighteningly pale with dark circles under her eyes. "What's wrong? Where are your guards?"
"Passed out. Maybe dead. My parents, too."
"What?" I asked incredulously.
"It started at the north end, closer to my place, but it's headed your way. I had to come warn you."
"What do you mean?" I asked. Echenia staggered into me, clutching my arm to support herself.
"It's in the air," she said in a raspy voice. "Can't you smell it?"
Lifting my head, I realized she was right. A perfumed smell, not completely bad, almost like a lily. And just as I became aware of it, I began to feel its effects too. My lips and tongue were tingling. My eyes were burning. A swirl of building nausea was churning in my belly. I looked over to Chester and Chomper. Both of them sat in their swings, barfing between their legs. I grabbed Echenia's hand. "Let's get in the house. We can call an ambulance to go to your place." Echenia could barely stand, so I put my arms around her shoulders and hurried over to Chomper and Chester. "Get in the house, guys. Come on." They followed Echenia and me, puking and stumbling all the way. Inside, Mom and Dad were passed out on the living room couch. Settling Echenia in a chair, I staggered toward the phone, but my head began to spin, and then I fell to my knees. It was the last thing I remembered. In the morning, I awoke where I'd fallen. Dad was just awakening, rubbing his head. He shook Mom, whose eyes slowly fluttered open. Chomper and Chester lay on the floor. I was relieved to hear Chomper mumble when Dad picked him up. Chester was harder to rouse, but finally came to after several very scary moments. I shook Echenia, but she was cold and lifeless.
"Mom!
Dad! She's dead!" I shouted. Dad sprang to my side and checked.
"Oh my God," he said, and kept repeating it. Lunging to his phone on the table, he tried to call the police, but the lines were busy. That evening, I went with Dad to a town meeting at the Lectus Center. We were among hundreds of people as we filed into the auditorium. In the afternoon, we had learned that Echenia's entire family was dead, including the bodyguards. Everyone at the North End had been wiped out. On our road, the people had only been sickened. I sat down feeling sad and scared. I hadn't known Echenia well, but seeing her there, so still and pale, it was horrible. Every time I pictured it, I had to stop myself from shaking. The head real estate agent on Lectus was a bald-headed guy with a British accent they called Sir Melvin. He was scurrying around, shaking hands, trying to do some panic control. The last thing he wanted was a mass exodus off Lectus. A panel was on the stage, and one by one, each of them gave his or her opinion about what had happened. A science fiction writer was sure it was an alien attack. The mayor of Lectus felt that some left-leaning newcomers had infiltrated the elite group and had launched a poison gas attack because of a grievance they felt against the massively wealthy of Lectus. An ecologist insisted that Lectus was emitting a natural defense to rid itself of the sudden onslaught of new inhabitants. When they took comments from the audience, I raised my hand. I was told that this had happened before. Members of the panel looked to one another, mystified by my comment. The mayor stood and scratched his head.
"I don't know who told you that, son, but I've never heard of it."
Sir Melvin stepped forward.
"This settlement has only been terraformed for the last 5 years. It's only in the last year that the planet has developed its own ozone layer, and the tents have been removed, enabling Gattus to land safely."
"Wasn't there a settlement here 10 years ago?" I asked.
"Absolutely not. The planet was uninhabitable then."
I knew he was lying. But why?
Probably because he thought that real estate sales would plummet if he told the truth about what had happened. At least that was my guess.
"It is a punishment from God."
All eyes turned to the short, white-haired man in the rumpled black suit. I recognized him from TV and magazines. He was the astronomer Schroeder Peterson. Had it been anyone less highly esteemed, he would have been jeered off the floor. But since he was the most renowned astronomer in the world, his startling words were met with hushed anticipation.
"A strange light has suddenly and unexpectedly appeared in the sky above Lectus," he explained. "It does not seem to be a star or sun. Possibly, it is an alien spacecraft of such immensity we cannot begin to fathom its size. My own belief is that we are being visited by God."
"Why would you think it is God?"
Sir Melvin asked respectfully.
"It is just my feeling," Schroeder Peterson replied.
That night we returned home and found Mom and Felicia in Chomper and Chester's room. My brothers were still feeling too sick to get out of bed. Felicia had stayed at her friend's house that night. When the strange gas came, they had all gone down into their basement, where there were no windows and hadn't become as overcome with the fumes as most of the other families around us. It was her good luck to have been visiting there at the time. Dad and I told Mom and Felicia how, by the end of the meeting, Schroeder Peterson had convinced the group that the key to discovering what had happened lay in contacting the light. They want a volunteer to go out in a space module and see if he or she can contact this strange light, Dad told Mom. No one volunteered. And then someone recognized me and wanted me to go. I guess because I always play the hero part, they figured I really am one.
"I hope you said no," Mom told him.
"Of course I did. I sure wasn't going to go and leave you here alone with the kids." I was actually a little embarrassed by the way Dad had told him that he absolutely wouldn't go. I could tell the others were disappointed that he wasn't living up to his big screen image. Dad continued telling about the light and was in mid-sentence when a deafening roar suddenly split our ears. The window smashed open, spraying glass everywhere. I clutched the bedpost with one hand and Chester with the other. A force was pulling us toward the window. Felicia shrieked as she rose in the air. In an instant, she was sucked backward out the window, bumping her head as she went. Then Chomper began to float upward, flailing his arms and screaming. Horrified, Mom and Dad reached out to him. Dad, holding onto the bedpost, caught Chomper's ankle. Mom grabbed Dad around the waist and took hold of Chomper's other leg. I held tight to Chester as a powerful sucking force lifted me too. It was as if I was hovering on a current of hot air. Then came a whine so high-pitched I felt as though my head would shatter. Chester was sucked out of my arms just before I dropped abruptly to the floor. The last sound I heard was my head banging as it hit. When I awoke hours later, it was pitch dark. "Dad?" I whispered as I slowly sat up. "Mom?" It was eerily quiet. An awful terror gripped me. Had my entire family really just been sucked out the window? The pain in my head was horrible, but I forced myself to stand and turn on a light. What I saw made me shake. The room was completely empty except for one bed that lay on its side. Hurrying to the window, I looked to see if any of them had been dropped to the ground. But no one was there. I ran outside and thrashed the bushes, calling Mom and Dad, searching for my sister and brothers.
"Phil?"
It was Dad, bleeding and badly scraped, but alive. He pulled me into an emotional hug.
"Thank God you're okay," he said.
"Where is everyone else?"
"I can't find them," I told him, my voice catching.
Dad and I searched for hours. We joined a crowd of people also looking for their families who had been swept up by the hot wind. Occasionally, one of them would get lucky and find an injured loved one who had been swept into a tall tree or been blown to a rooftop. But Dad and I couldn't find a trace of Mom, Felicia, Chomper, or Chester.
"What do we do now?"
I asked Dad, exhausted and fighting back tears. "I'm volunteering to go to the light," he said. "If that light has Mom and my kids, I want them back. If I have to finally be a hero for real, then that's what I'll be." I realized I was sweating. Dad was drenched with perspiration as well. And I was squinting because the sky had turned a vivid, nearly blinding yellow. I had a front row seat for the launch of the space module being sent to the strange light. The eager, fascinated crowd gathered at the site wearing black sunglasses to protect them from the strong rays of the light. Dad was already in the module. As he walked out to the pad in his heat-proof spacesuit, he'd looked every inch the hero he always played. I shook his hand and told him how proud I was of him. "Don't worry, Phil. I'll be back," he'd said. As we waited for the module to take off, a kind of giddiness was overtaking the crowd. It was almost as though they were getting drunk on the light pouring onto us.
"I wish I was going too,"
an elderly man beside me said.
"Me too. Take me to the light,"
a woman shouted, lifting her hands toward it.
"Take me. Take me,"
screamed another woman, arms raised, swaying rapturously. Soon everyone was yearning to go toward the light. A man in a suit tapped me on the shoulder. "Would you like to come into the control room and watch the takeoff on our closed circuit monitor?" he offered. I thanked him and said I would. I watched in the darkened room with a handful of technicians as the module took off. "Now we're going to closed circuit inside the module," a technician with red hair announced. For a second, I saw Dad sitting at the helm of the cramped cockpit. Then, abruptly, the screen fuzzed before going blank. "We've lost visual," the technician stated the obvious. "The immense heat must be sending solar flares."
"Let's hope the heat panels hold," said the man in the suit.
I sat with my stomach in knots as Dad's voice came into the room. I wished I could have seen him, but at least I could hear him. "I have left Lectus's atmosphere and am heading toward the mysterious light. My solar defense suit is equipped with an internal cooling device. I'm glad of that because already it's scorching up here," he reported.
For several long minutes he was silent. As the module gets closer, the light is increasingly blinding. I'm flipping the anti-glare visor down over my helmet, he said finally. I'm attempting to contact the light with a series of laser signals. Nothing. More silence behind the hum of the speakers. I wondered why he wasn't speaking. The light is just out there, he said, and I noticed that his voice had lost its commanding strength. If it is, in fact, God, it is not responding, he spoke again, his voice weaker still. I'm not sure what to do next. Even with this suit on, I'm sweating. I stood, alarmed. Tell him to come back, I said. Can't, the technician said. We've lost two-way. That light is affecting our communication signals. You'll be okay, said the man in the suit. The next time Dad spoke, he sounded drunk, though I knew he couldn't be. A strange feeling is taking hold of me. A certainty of what I have to do next, he reported. It's as if I have no choice anymore. I know this is crazy, but I can't stop myself. I'm going to leave the module to go to the light. No! I shouted as a deafening crackle filled the control room. It is now a year later, and I am back on Earth living with my aunt and uncle. They have brought me to a special session of an investigative committee in Washington, D.C. I sit anxiously waiting as a senator takes to the podium. Ladies and gentlemen, this session of our committee is called to order. We have finally recovered the space module flown by John Biggs Borodaj. As you know, for some reason we have yet to understand, the heroic Mr. Borodaj chose to leave his spacecraft in a delusional attempt to go toward the light. However, we have recovered the badly charred module and discovered that its recorder caught these voices. What you are about to hear might be the voices of an alien race far more sophisticated than our own, or, as the esteemed Dr. Peterson has suggested, it could, in fact, be the very voice of God. I sat forward, my fists clenched in anticipation. In the next minute, the module's recorder was played over the public address system. Female voice. Damned fleas! I don't know how we got this infestation. The cat probably brought them in. Nothing gets rid of them. I've tried spraying insecticide. I'm sick of vacuuming. The only thing that works at all are these flea traps. They can't help but jump to the light bulb, and then they fall on the sticky paper below. It's weird to think that such tough little survivors have such a stupid streak. Who knows why they jump into the light? They just can't help themselves, I guess.
The Perfects by Jennifer Allison. Read by Caitlin Davies.
The chances are pretty good that I'm going to be killed before daylight. And I can't help but think this never would have happened if we hadn't moved to Entrails, Michigan. I know there's no point in thinking this way, but really, there's nothing I can do but sit here and think. I've already panicked, banged on the bars of my cage, and searched for an escape. Now all I can do is consider how I got into this situation in the first place. Naturally, I find myself wishing I could rewind time, wishing I could go back and redo any of the events and choices that led me to the end of the road. Did I mention I wouldn't be stuck here now if we hadn't moved? That part certainly wasn't my choice. My dad lost his job in Detroit, and when neither he nor my mother could find work in their fields, they got the bright idea to move to a small town in the country. My mother managed to find a teaching job, but my father's plans were vague. Some days, he said he planned to start his own business. Other days, he said he planned to write a best-selling novel or become an organic farmer. At any rate, both of my parents were convinced that out here in Entrails, we could live like kings for very little money. And they weren't about to take the advice of a 15-year-old girl who didn't want to move. My parents bought a new house that was about 5 times the size of our old house in the Detroit suburbs.
"And we got it for a song," my father crowed.
It was a foreclosed property. The previous owners had just stopped paying the bills and left town. Our new house was enormous. But the house next to ours was even bigger. A mansion 4 stories tall with 2 towers that popped up from the roof, reminding me of turrets on a medieval castle.
"That house next door is an amazing example of Victorian architecture, Hannah," my mom declared when we first arrived in our new neighborhood.
"Our family and the neighbors next door have the best houses in the whole town," my dad added. "In this town, we're like royalty."
That was the moment I first glimpsed something disturbing, something I did my best to ignore. In an upstairs window of the house next door, a shadowy figure parted the lace curtains and stared down at our car. I had the distinct sense that someone up there was looking at us, sizing us up. But I told myself I was just feeling anxious about being in a new place. My parents and I went inside to check out the long hallways and empty rooms in our new house. I was trying to decide between 2 large bedrooms on the 2nd floor when someone rang the doorbell. I heard my mother open the door.
"Hello. I wanted to welcome you to our neighborhood."
It was a woman who spoke with a smooth, formal voice. Curious, I stepped out of the 2nd floor bedroom and leaned over the hallway banister to listen more closely.
"My name is Rebecca Perfect," the woman announced. "I live in the house next door."
"Oh, nice to meet you."
In contrast, my mother's voice sounded nasal, high-pitched, and nervous.
"Your house is just beautiful."
From my perch, I saw my mom hurriedly tucking her frizzy hair behind her ears, something she does when she feels embarrassed or intimidated.
"I noticed you have a teenage daughter," said the woman.
"Why, yes, Hannah is 15. Hannah, are you up there?"
My mother turned and saw me peeking over the banister.
"Oh, there you are, Hannah. Come say hello to our next door neighbor."
I trudged downstairs to meet Rebecca Perfect. You've got to hand it to Mrs. Perfect. On first impression, she really lives up to her name. She wore a neatly tailored pantsuit, designer shoes with tiny heels, and black leather gloves. Not a hair was out of place. She smiled with approval as she swiftly eyed me from head to toe. "Hi," I said, extending my hand.
"Does Hannah babysit?"
Mrs. Perfect directed her question to my mother as she shook my hand with a limp grip that was more of a pinch than a handshake.
"Oh, yes. Hannah is a very experienced babysitter. Right, Hannah?"
"I'm so glad," said Mrs.
Perfect, before I had a chance to answer.
"I realize this is a last-minute request, but my husband and I have a very important engagement tonight. Could you come over to our place at about 7 o'clock, Hannah?"
"Okay," I said, "but don't your kids go trick-or-treating on Halloween night?"
"They prefer to celebrate the holiday at home."
I'd like to tell you that I had some sense of foreboding about a last-minute babysitting invitation on Halloween night, but I didn't. I was thrilled, even relieved. For one thing, it was nice to have any kind of social invitation in a town where I knew absolutely nobody. Besides, I've always liked kids, probably because children and babies have always been drawn to me. Babies like pulling on my long ponytail and hoop earrings, and older kids like the silly games they make up after their parents leave the house. Back in my old neighborhood, I made a small fortune as a babysitter. In fact, when my dad lost his job, he joked that I was going to have to step in as the breadwinner of the family. With no friends in my new neighborhood, I figured I might as well spend Halloween night babysitting. As I was contemplating my luck at finding a babysitting job so quickly, Mrs. Perfect pulled her cell phone from her purse, opened it, and snapped my picture with a single swift movement. "For my children," she explained, punching a number into her phone with her gloved finger. "So you won't be a complete stranger when you come over." "Oh, sure." Nobody had ever taken my picture in advance of a babysitting job before. Maybe she's actually taking the picture as a security precaution, since she doesn't know me well, I thought. Well, in hindsight, I know that Mrs. Perfect was telling the truth. The photo really was for her kids, just not in the way I expected. "So, we live next door to the Perfects," I remarked wryly after we said goodbye to our new neighbor. "I guess we're moving up in the world." "Isn't it funny?" My mom grabbed a pair of scissors and cut open one of the storage boxes that were stacked in the room. "Here I am looking my worst, and who comes over but Mrs. Perfect?" Oh, it was funny, all right. If you like being killed, this whole thing is hilarious. It's hard to believe that just hours ago, I was sitting on a window seat in my new bedroom, peering down into the next-door neighbor's backyard and feeling almost happy as I spied on Mrs. Perfect's three kids, a girl and a boy who appeared to be about 5 or 6, and a baby girl who looked as if she were about 1 year old. The children were cute, but something about their demeanor seemed joyless and somber, older than their years. Sitting silently in an old-fashioned baby buggy, even the baby struck me as unusually reserved and serious as she sucked on her bottle. Surrounding the children were some of the most enthusiastic backyard Halloween decorations I had ever seen. Tiny ghosts made of gauzy material dangled from tree branches, dancing in the wind. The lawn resembled a tiny church graveyard filled with small, fake tombstones. Well, I assumed they were fake. It's funny how the scene struck me as simultaneously adorable and sad. For some reason, I felt sorry for those strangely forlorn little kids. I imagined myself befriending them, reading funny stories, playing hide-and-seek in the yard, tickling the baby's toes and making her giggle. I must have dozed off while sitting in the window seat daydreaming, because the next thing I knew, all three children had vanished from the garden below. I felt strangely dizzy, so I decided to take a walk and get some fresh air. I quickly realized that it took only about 10 minutes to see just about everything there was to see in the town of Entrails. A dollar store, a bakery, a McDonald's, a gas station, a church, a dentist's office, a bar called Tim's Lounge, and a gift shop called Sweet Memories that sold sentimental greeting cards, candles, and hundreds of dolls and stuffed animals dressed up in elaborate costumes. A large, vintage-looking sign on the wall in Sweet Memories announced, "Custom-built dolls, real hair, order today." I had never seen so much velvet and lace in one store, and I couldn't help wondering how a store that sold mostly dolls could stay in business in such a small town. It was as silent as a tomb in the store. I was the only customer in sight. As I browsed shelves stacked with floppy-eared rabbits wearing petticoats and dolls with clear blue glass eyes that stared out of painted porcelain faces, the ladies working at the checkout counter observed me with prim, unfriendly interest. All three were middle-aged, dressed in colorful, preppy sweaters.
"She's the one,"
I heard one of the ladies whisper. I felt paranoid. Were they talking about me?
"They already moved into the Morgan house?"
The other lady didn't even try to lower her voice. Morgan was the name of the family who used to live in our new house. Now I felt certain they were talking about me.
"I recognize her from the rush order we got in earlier today."
What rush order? I wondered. What were they talking about?
"Shame about the Morgans. They say one person's misfortune is another's opportunity."
Were they annoyed that my family had snapped up their former neighbor's foreclosed property? It wasn't my family's fault the Morgans couldn't pay their mortgage, was it?
Shame about that poor girl Jessica, too.
Who in the world was Jessica? And what happened to her? Now I was too curious to keep quiet. I figured these ladies knew just about everything that went on in the town of Entrails, so I thought I'd try to talk to them.
"Excuse me," I ventured. "I couldn't help overhearing you. My name is Hannah, and my family just moved into the house the Morgans used to own."
The three women stared as if they were shocked that I knew how to talk. One of them refused to make eye contact. She looked down, pretended to shuffle some papers, then turned and walked away, shaking her head. Was I going to be a social outcast in my new town?
Sorry to interrupt your work, I said, secretly reflecting that they had actually been standing there doing nothing. I'm just curious about the neighborhood, and I heard you mention something about the Morgans, the people who used to live in our house.
You don't know what happened to the Morgans?
The woman standing at the cash register squinted at me, as if trying to see me more clearly. I shook my head. As far as I knew, my parents didn't know either.
They had a girl about your age, she said coldly. She went missing. Nobody knows exactly what happened, but she's gone.
At these words, I felt a cold sensation in my bones, like a warning from my own body. I guess my body was smarter than my brain.
We can guess what happened,
the other lady mumbled.
Carol!
The other lady shot Carol a warning glance, as if telling her to put a lid on it.
You don't want to scare the girl.
I think she has a right to know something.
Carol turned back to me and gave me a pointed look.
Anyway, things have a way of falling apart after something like that.
I already knew we had moved to a small, boring town, but now it seemed that we had moved to a small, creepy, not to mention decidedly unfriendly town. What in the world had my parents been thinking?
So, what do you think happened to Jessica? I asked.
All we can tell you is that none of the Morgans are around anymore.
Well, thanks for the info, I said, feeling overwhelmed and suddenly wanting to get out of that store as quickly as possible.
Just be careful around here, Carol warned.
I will, I said, not having the faintest idea how exactly I was supposed to be careful.
A fall storm was brewing as I approached the Perfect's house in darkness. Dry leaves stirred and whispered in the warm wind, reminding me of tornado weather.
Hello, Hannah. Mrs. Perfect greeted me at the door.
Her slender figure was defined by an elegantly tailored black dress, a long strand of pearls, and shiny high heels.
Thank you for coming over at such short notice.
Mrs. Perfect spoke with a cool familiarity, once again eyeing me up and down, as if conducting a quick assessment of my skin, hair, and body. Registering a tiny smile, she stepped aside so I could walk past her. I felt her eyes on me as she followed me into an enormous, high-ceilinged kitchen, where two of the children I had observed through the window earlier in the day sat on stools around a high table, eating dinner. The kids regarded me with mild interest, but without smiling.
Hannah, these are my children, Maddie and Jackson.
Maddie and Jackson said hello and then turned back to watching a large flat-screen television. I don't think I had ever met anybody whose kitchen contained such a huge flat-screen television. As I mentioned before, I've always liked children. Kids of all ages, sizes, colors, and shapes. In my experience, there's always something funny or cute about even the most difficult or homely child. But strangely, I found myself reflecting that Maddie and Jackson had looked a whole lot cuter from the safe distance of my bedroom window. Up close, something was wrong with these two kids. I just couldn't put my finger on what exactly it was. Maybe it was the way their blue eyes had a glassy, puffy look that suggested illness. Their rosy, flushed cheeks looked feverish instead of healthy. Maybe they're fighting a flu bug, I thought. But then I realized that it wasn't so much their appearance, but what they were doing and what they were watching that made these two children instinctively unappealing. Maddie's and Jackson's sharp knives and forks clinked against their plates as they carved nearly raw slabs of steak, their white porcelain plates stained with bloodied juices. While they ate, they calmly watched television footage of a surgical procedure with the volume muted. Chewing their red meat and gulping their milk, they stared as scalpels made incisions and clamps revealed internal organs. You like watching this stuff? I was baffled by the family's choice of viewing material during a meal. The kids nodded with blank expressions. I wanted to ask Mrs. Perfect whether her children always watch surgical procedures during meals, but before I could say anything, she placed a piece of paper in front of me, a set of typed, detailed instructions. She would be meeting her husband at a Halloween gathering where she couldn't be reached by phone. Maddie and Jackson were allowed to watch television, followed by an early bedtime. She expected to be back home no later than 10 p.m.
Help yourself to anything you'd like in the kitchen, Hannah, said Mrs. Perfect, opening the refrigerator door to reveal a sparse collection of yogurts and a plate littered with the bones of a small animal that didn't look like anything I had ever eaten before.
And what about the baby? I asked. What's her schedule? Mrs. Perfect frowned.
What baby?
Again, you have to give Mrs. Perfect some credit for playing her role so well. She seemed so genuinely taken aback by my comment, I actually felt embarrassed and a little ashamed for asking it. Sorry, I said, but I thought I saw a baby with Maddie and Jackson in your backyard earlier today. Out of the corner of my eye, I thought I perceived the faintest twitch of amusement on the meat-stained lips of the children.
Maybe you saw one of Maddie's dolls, said Mrs. Perfect curtly.
Wasn't there a baby outside with you guys earlier today? I turned to Maddie and Jackson. She was holding a bottle. Maddie and Jackson stared at me with inscrutable expressions and shook their heads without speaking. Their reluctance to speak annoyed me. It seemed more like an aggressive reluctance than innocent shyness. Moreover, I was bewildered by the contradiction between what I had seen and what Mrs. Perfect was telling me. If Maddie and Jackson were the only children who lived in this house, who was the baby I had seen in their garden? Had I imagined her? Had I seen a ghost? Well, I'd better be going, said Mrs. Perfect, throwing a vintage fox wrap around her shoulders that, bizarrely, still had the fox's head attached. I'll be back by 10 o'clock at the latest. She gave Maddie and Jackson a quick peck on the cheek and left without another word. So, I said, pulling up a stool to sit next to the children, what kind of surgery are we watching here? I did my best to sound friendly and nonchalant, to conceal my squeamishness. Appendectomy, muttered Jackson. I prefer to watch brain surgery, I joked. The kids regarded me with surprise, but they didn't laugh. I tried a different approach. Are you guys interested in becoming surgeons someday? Both kids shook their heads.
Our dad used to own a medical devices company, Jackson explained, but he wasn't a surgeon.
What kind of devices did his company make? All kinds, said Maddie. But he sold the company. That's how we got our money. I see. I got the impression that quite a lot of money came from that medical devices company. I doubted I'd be running into the perfect children working at the Sweet Memories store or the local McDonald's. How about some dessert? I eyed the blobs of bloody juice and fat on the kids' plates and felt a little unnerved when I noticed that Jackson had apparently eaten part of a bone. I opened a cabinet and was relieved when I saw ordinary, unhealthy snacks, potato chips, Cheetos, Oreo cookies. Not one of the packages had been opened. No thanks, said Maddie. We just keep those for babysitters. Maybe some ice cream? I pressed. I absent-mindedly opened a cabinet door to look for more snacks and discovered the most extensive and elaborate collection of kitchen knives I had ever seen in anyone's house. Was it my imagination? Or were there some surgical tools amid the knives, too? I slammed the cabinet door shut.
I'm saving my appetite for later, said Jackson.
I saw Maddie kick her brother under the table, as if nudging him to be quiet. After the kids dutifully washed their dishes and put them in the dishwasher, Maddie announced that she was going upstairs to her room to read. This was a little disappointing, since kids usually want to spend time with me. But it was clear that she didn't want any company. There was nothing to do but follow Jackson into the family room. After watching a surgery in the Perfect's kitchen, I should have been prepared for their living room, but I wasn't. No fewer than 3 enormous television screens displayed silent, repeating black and white film segments of striking violence.